Turn with me to Psalm 2. Now, I don't think this is going to happen, and I hope that it is not the case. But imagine for a moment Pastor Adam and Caleb heading to Nashville, Brentwood Baptist Church, huge building, beautiful, all these great speakers scheduled to attend, Alistair Begg, David Platt, D.A. Carson. Pastor Adam's over here just drooling right now. I'm just so excited. I can't wait to get there. Great musicians of all kinds, breakout sessions. They arrive tonight. Everything starts tomorrow. But just imagine when they arrive tonight, Brentwood Baptist, doors are locked. Registration tomorrow morning. They arrive and there's a big tent out in the parking lot. Porta potties. The worst scene possible. Rows of porta potties, right? There are thousands of people that are supposed to be at this event. Church is locked. Big tent. Porta potties. Small stage. No chairs. Everyone's just standing around. And the facilitator of the conference, the Gettys, get up there, and there's no electrical material. There's no generator providing power. There's no outlets. It's one guitar. And it's the Gettys there, and we're here to sing. People would be looking around, all right, we paid money. We're supposed to have food. They do have a small food tent set up. It's the MREs, essentially. It's rations, and so it's military-grade peanut butter, right, for this is what you're eating for a couple of days. They had expectations of things working and everything operating well and the lineup of speakers being followed exactly and all that they were supposed to be equipped with, and they get there and it's a skeleton version of this. Silly illustration, just to bring the issue to the fore, that for the apostles and for many following Jesus, there were expectations that had been sent out, and those expectations had far more authority than a flyer or a website or a registration about a conference. This is the Old Testament itself, and expectations of what Messiah would be like when he came, the kinds of things he would do and say, and the kingdom he would institute. And the point of connection here between the Sing Conference and the apostles, these folks are going to the Sing Conference are hoping to participate in something. Part of the joy, I'm going, guys, I don't know if I told you that, so I just decided recently, last couple of minutes, part of the joy is hearing people and getting equipped, but it's going to be singing with them, right? It's participation. It's when the auditorium is filled with some of the best musicians in the world and you're singing to God together with all the joy and wonder of gifted expression. I'm participating in this. And part of the framework of Judaism from the Old Testament until the time of Jesus is that when Messiah comes, I'm going to participate. It's not just attending. I'm a participant. I'm singing. If someone on stage hands me a guitar, I'm going to play it. Psalm 2. Why do the nations rebel? The peoples plot in vain. The kings of the earth take their stand. The rulers conspire together against the Lord and his anointed one. Let us tear off their chains and free ourselves from their restraints. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord ridicules them. Then he speaks to them in his anger, terrifies them in his wrath. I have consecrated my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will declare the Lord's decree. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will shatter them like pottery. So now, kings, be wise. Receive instruction, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with reverential awe and rejoice with trembling. Pay homage to the Son, or he will be angry, and you will perish in your rebellion, for his anger may ignite at any moment. All those who take refuge in him are happy. It's not difficult to put that poem together, is it? Sometimes poetry can cause us to pause. How do we understand this element or that one? Not so much here. Here, the psalmist understands himself to be the king, the anointed one, and proleptically looking ahead to the coming of the Messiah, the anointed one who will rule, and part of that rule is crushing the enemies and establishing a kingdom. Underneath Psalm 2, just at the surface of nearly every line, is conquest and dominion. And that's going to happen, and there's going to be reciprocal blessings understood for those who would be in Messiah's train, if you will. Progress. Isaiah 61. This text will be familiar once your eyes land upon it. Isaiah 61. Familiar because Jesus quotes it. We've seen it several times there in Luke 4 in Nazareth. Luke 4, 18 and 19. Isaiah 61, 1 and 2. But read the whole chapter with me. See if you can find points of contact with Psalm 2 that we just read. The Spirit of the Lord God is on me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, freedom to the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the day of our God's vengeance, to comfort all who mourn, to provide for those who mourn in Zion, to give them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, festive oil instead of mourning, and splendid clothes instead of despair. They will be called righteous trees planted by the Lord to glorify Him. They will rebuild the ancient ruins. They will restore the former devastations. They will renew the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations. Strangers will stand and feed their flocks, and foreigners will be plowmen, your plowmen, and vine dressers. But you will be called the Lord's priests. They will speak of you as ministers of our God. You will eat the wealth of the nations, and you will boast in their riches. Because your shame was double, and they cried out, disgrace is their portion. Therefore, they will possess double in their land, and eternal joy will be theirs. For I, the Lord, love justice. I hate robbery and injustice. I will faithfully reward them. Make an everlasting covenant with them. Their descendants will be known among the nations, their posterity among the peoples. All who see them will recognize that they are a people the Lord has blessed. I greatly rejoice in the Lord. I exult in my God, for he has clothed me with garments of salvation, wrapped me in a robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom wears a turban, and as a bride adorns herself with jewels. For as the earth brings forth its growth, and as a garden enables what is sown to spring up, so the Lord will cause righteousness and praise to spring up before all the nations. Now, not exactly the same kind of writing, not in the same book, but many ideas cohere. an anointed one of the Lord coming and speaking blessing and praise, defeating enemies, establishing a remnant here described as trees growing up and prosperity, and their enemies so weak that they are tilling their ground. They are taking care of Israel's things, and God's people are edified, and here is righteousness. They are participating in what Messiah has brought forth. That's the point. This is what is expected. If we read the Old Testament well, I think we enter into the Gospels with a bit of sympathy for the audiences, both Jesus' disciples and even his opponents at times, for what Jesus says and how shocking it is, how new, just how different. This is where we find ourselves today. Fast forward with me then to Luke. We'll be in Luke 9, but to call attention again to Luke 4. In Nazareth, Jesus quotes Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2, and he speaks this of himself. This is the time that this has been fulfilled. The Lord's Spirit is upon Jesus, and he is ready to announce what's going to happen. And the next several chapters, Jesus unpacks these ideas personally. He demonstrates this superior power. Recovery of sight to the blind, forgiveness of sins, release of the captives. This becomes the framework that Jesus demonstrates the next several chapters. And along the way, beginning in chapter 5, but especially so in chapter 9, Jesus has called these nearest him to follow him in a more proximal way, to be entrusted with ministry. And as we arrive at chapter 9, we notice that Jesus commissions the 12 and he sends them out. And what kind of a result does Luke report them having? It's success. It's success. Verse 6, they went out and traveled from village to village proclaiming the good news and healing everywhere. Verse 10, when the apostles returned, they reported to Jesus all they had done. Such success that Jesus was ready to pull them away and refresh them a bit, give them a break, a small retreat or vacation. They had done the very activities that Jesus was doing. They were now starting to participate in supernatural power. Common fisherman, tax collector, called to Jesus, empowered in this unique way. So great is their power in the midst of Luke 9 here. Herod the Tetrarch hears about the spreading power and is concerned for who this Jesus is. And it's here in Luke 9 where we have streams, if you will, flowing down into a common river. Streams of Jesus' prophetic actions in Nazareth there with Isaiah 61 and 62. Another stream of the disciples following after him and his teaching of them. Maybe another stream of miracles. And all of these streams are cohering to one river, to one destination, to one key issue. And that issue is, who is this man? Who is he? Because he has these powers, he speaks these texts, but he has not yet operated in this kingdom dominion fashion. He has not employed the kinds of means that Messiah would be thought to employ. By faith, just following through the drama of Luke 9, Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" Verse 18. Their answer was very similar to Herod's query earlier, Elijah, one of the prophets. "But you," Jesus answered, verse 20, "but you, who do you say that I am?" And Peter, by faith, exclaimed what? "You're the Christ, you're God's Messiah, you are the one." And he proclaims this message by faith, and it's here, where in each of the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, recording the sequence, at each of these points, you can sort of see the book start to progress in a picked-up speed. A rate increases here. There's a public confession, and immediately, Jesus censures some of what might be in the back of their mind. What does Jesus begin to speak about? Right after Peter's confession that you're the Messiah, you're the expected one. It's the cross. The Son of Man is going to suffer. He's going to be betrayed. He's going to be handed over to the Jewish leadership, expressed in different ways. He's going to suffer. He's going to die. And then these statements about you take up your cross and follow after me. So strange is this that the transfiguration, just in the flow of the chapter here, as well as Mark 8 and Matthew 16, functions in some way as a reinforcement of Peter. Yes, he is the Messiah, but he's going to be more than you think. He's going to be a Messiah, the Son of God, who suffers and dies. Unexpected and strange. But he is. And the transfiguration surfaces in two ways. One, to reinforce Peter's faith, but also to instruct Peter. Because there, in the vision on the Mount of Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah are speaking to Jesus in Luke's language about Jesus' exodus that he's going to come upon in Jerusalem. That is, his death. Messiah dying? And it's here where messianism is expanded beyond what was expected. It's here where the tent, the porta-potties, the rations, somehow, simply because of the quality of the music, become glorious. And this is where we find ourselves in Luke 9. Thinking yet, part 3 of how the cross demonstrates the power of God's kingdom. You have a bulletin before you. The flow that we will follow this morning moves from verses 37 to 43, then 44 to 45, and then 46 to 50. And the flow of thought, something like this. Jesus' ability to drive out a demon that even his newly emboldened disciples could not drive out. It seemed inconsistent with the cross. Such power. And then he immediately speaks about the cross, and that seems entirely inconsistent. But that is going to be the very pattern of faithfulness, of trust in God, that ministry is all about. That's what ministry springs from. Such drama in just these three scenes. Let's follow the text. Verse 37. The next day, that is after the transfiguration, disciples in awe, not saying anything, verse 36, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met Jesus. Just then, a man from the crowd cried out. This is not a new situation, is it? We've seen this before in Luke. When someone is in danger, they will come to Jesus or they will send a delegation to Jesus because he is known as one who is powerful. At times, Jesus just comes upon a scene where there's a need, the widow's son, dead, being raised up. In either situation, people coming to Jesus or Jesus coming upon a situation of need, he is known as power. And that's where we are. Teacher, verse 38, I beg you to look at my son because he's my only child. Often a spirit seizes him. Suddenly he shrieks and it throws him into convulsions until he foams at the mouth, wounding him. It hardly ever leaves him. At the end of verse 39, we again recognize this is not a new pattern. Others have come to Jesus with this kind of a situation, not specifically, but some kind of a need. And we've seen Jesus address that situation, inquire of the faith of the person, and maybe some teaching along the way. But it seems that in each instance, he is more powerful than whatever the opposition is, be it a demon or a disease, whatever, he is more powerful. This is not new, but there is something new now. The new element here is a part of the flow of Luke 9, because Luke 9 begins with what? Luke 9 begins with Jesus delegating supernatural authority. Delegating power. You will go do what I have done. And what is the result? Success. Notice then the drama. Verse 40. I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not. If we're reading well, this verse should cause us to stop for a moment. The unfaithfulness of the disciples received Jesus' attention. Verse 41, "You unbelieving and rebellious generation, how long will I be with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." What does Jesus call the disciples here, verse 41? Rebellious, unbelieving. It brings to mind Moses' statements, to reference him again in the chapter about Israel at times. You are rebellious and unbelieving. If you have acted this way while I was with you, what is it going to be when I am gone? Just read the last few chapters of Deuteronomy and see how Jesus echoes Moses here. You unbelieving, you rebellious generation, you who are not trusting in God. Kent Hughes comments, "The root of the apostles' powerlessness was their unbelief. They had subtly moved from trust in God to faith in the process, which is to say, faith in themselves. This is evidenced by their lack of prayer, as Jesus briefly notes in Mark's account, Mark 9, 28-29. True prayer is an act of faith, and vital, authentic faith, believing, exists only in a life of perpetual, dependent prayer. Sure, we've done this before. This is becoming common. You can see the remaining disciples there. Peter, James, and John have been with Jesus, the remaining there. This is common. This is the normal routine. Come on out. Be out of him. Be clean. You can see the strain in their faces as disciple after disciple begins to speak and nothing happens and nothing happens. We can look at them and say, how foolish. Just pray, just seek God. But what if we turned that around and looked in the mirror for a moment? How easy it is for us to just go through the routines of life without a thought of how much we depend upon God. I'm amazed at how many Christians I talk to and I speak with them about just their prayer life. And do you begin your day with prayer? I'm too busy. I have so many things to do. I have young kids. I have a job. I have a boss. I have employees. I have this. I have that. Who do we think we are? Do we realize the arrogance of our position here? And perhaps most sad is we go about these things and we say, well, it's all for the Lord. My family's all about the Lord. My work's all about the Lord. My things are all about the Lord. Can't 10 minutes to pray to start the day? How much are we really depending on God? How much is really about Jesus Christ? One way to know if something is really about God is if you pray for it and you don't have to. You don't do it because someone's holding you accountable. If God doesn't help me, I don't survive. That's Christianity. That's living under the lordship of Christ. This is about you, God. So it would be obvious then to pray. And not in a way where I have to have somebody keep me accountable. I have to do this. I have to do that. It's about God. I wonder how regularly our lives could be categorized as you rebellious, unbelieving. But it's not just going through the motions of prayer, is it? It's believing. It's trusting. its relationship, its union, its God. This is my participation in what you are doing. That enlivens prayer. God, I'm about you. My life is about you. I am participating with you. I believe this is what you are doing, so I'm involved in it. And it is a spiritual discipline, but it's my life. It's who I am. Jesus' power was not limited. Look at verse 42. As the boy was still approaching in all the drama of Luke 9, just in one or two verses, the demon knocked the boy, threw him into a severe convulsion right there in front of Jesus. Here's exhibit A of how bad it is, and the disciples could do nothing about it. Verse 42, halfway through the verse, your translation likely has some kind of a contrast there. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, cured the boy, and gave him back to his father. Do you notice how quickly Luke 9:42b runs? The text speaks with staccato fashion. He did this, he did this, it's over. No problems is the idea. How much more tightly, how much more economically could the text be arranged? Jesus rebuked, it went out, he gave him back. Disciple after disciple couldn't do anything. Jesus, this is his power. We would be, verse 43, likewise. They are all astounded at the greatness of God. This is another refrain from Luke 4 to Luke 9. We could look back. Who is this who forgives sins? People rejoiced. God has visited his people, they said. Who is this Jesus? His great power, and they're astonished. Are you seeing how this heightens the tension of the chapter? Look at the flow. Look at what immediately follows. While everyone was amazed, verse 43, while people were still amazed, that the nine could do nothing, and Jesus just instantly fixes the situation. People are amazed at all the things he was doing, not just in this instance, but others. Letting one recall several, he told his disciples, look at verse 44, and just how shocking this would be. In fact, it's so shocking that Jesus prefaces it with a statement. We do this sometime if we are going to have to negotiate a situation. We may make a certain statement. Now, I know you don't want to hear this, but, or I hate to say this, but, or hey, I've got some news. And so you need a segue. You need a bit of an opening because what you're about to say isn't likely to be received happily or something along those lines. Let these words sink in, verse 44. In other words, I know you may not want to hear this. This may not fit what you're thinking. The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. And if there were ever two ideas that did not cohere, Jesus' power over this demon-possessed boy, just in an instant, and the statement that he's going to be betrayed, I would suggest are two statements that do not cohere. Do you agree? It doesn't fit. You cannot go north and south at the same time. One body cannot do that. These are contrary. So let's have just a bit of sympathy with the apostles as they are growing, with the disciples, because their frame of thought has been brewing for years about who Messiah is, what he is going to do, and the cross is not on their mind. Darrell Bach, what seems to be in view is a failure to appreciate and apprehend the magnitude and synthesis of what was said and how it would fit into God's program, rather than a complete lack of comprehension. In their view, the Messiah was to be a glorious, eternal figure, not a crushed and dying one. Matthew notes that the remarks left the disciples greatly distressed. It would take more instruction in the events themselves to permit the disciples to really understand what God was doing. Verse 45, they didn't understand at the moment. It was concealed. They couldn't fully grasp the reality of what seemed to be contradictory ideas. They had yet to have their messianic framework expanded so that glory, like a crown, could be experienced by something of lowly status like a cross. So Jesus unpacks it for them. Jesus' ability to drive out a demon that even his disciples, newly emboldened, couldn't. It didn't seem consistent with the cross. That's where we're at so far. And so Jesus provides an illustration, and then there's an actual instance where he can teach about the kind of faithfulness that he is demonstrating and that he wants his disciples to follow. Looking at Psalm 2, Isaiah 61, and thinking about Jesus' greatness in verses 42 and 43, if we put all of that together, we can better understand verse 46. What happened after this great event and the power? Verse 46, an argument started among them about who would be greatest. And again, on the surface, this may seem just like absolute foolishness. But if we allow ourselves a bit of sympathy, a bit of pre-understanding for these disciples, even here, though Jesus has spoken about the cross, this event and his power, despite their failures, the increased exposure they have, even if it's limited success, they're still insiders, with greater anticipation and expectation, they're hoping for the kingdom to come. This kind of a conversation is not entirely out of the reach of understanding. An argument, even, about who would be greatest. Arguing about it assumes what? They think that there is going to be rank in the kingdom, which means they think they are going to participate in it. To argue about something, you have to believe in it. To believe in it means you assume some characteristics about it, and part of that's going to be greatness, and they are going to apprehend that and participate in it. What we'll see in verses 47, 48, all the way through verse 50 is Jesus doesn't rebuke the idea of participation. He doesn't lessen the degree of the cross. He expands the cross and shows how they can participate in it now, along the way. The kind of faithfulness that will be exemplified by him and that they should then follow him. Verse 47, Jesus, knowing the thoughts of their hearts, took a little child and had him stand next to him. And he told them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. Whoever welcomes me welcomes him who sent me. For whoever is least among you, this one is great." Jesus has just talked about being betrayed, verse 44. If we skip back to verse 22, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests, scribes, be killed and raised the third day. If anyone wants to come with me, he must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. What we have here is an object lesson in status. Essentially, Jesus' logic moves along the lines of a comparison of status. Perhaps an illustration would help, just quickly. This week, former military servant of our country was imprisoned for leaking classified information, was subsequently released, and this week an Ivy League school extended a fellowship to this individual, and the next day that fellowship was rescinded because the CIA just had an uproar. How could we have this former prisoner who's admitted to leaking classified information, was released for a different reason, and now extended hospitality at an Ivy League school. No way. Number of officials made statements against that, and it was rescinded. In the ancient world, if someone committed a crime against Rome, the result was the cross. It wasn't a fellowship at an Ivy League school. It was the cross. The cross was a place of lowly status for liars, for criminals, for slaves who would escape and be caught. They would be crucified. And the mechanism of a cross provided a public display of a shameful final consequence. It functioned to end that person's life, but it also functioned to project power to the masses. Don't be like that person. And Jesus, telling his disciples to take up the cross, he tells them to embrace the lowliest status possible, because that's going to be his status. Notice the text and the operative word welcome, verse 48. Whoever welcomes this little child in my name, and it may be the case that little child here is the little child who was just healed. Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. But here's the irony. To welcome a child does not accord with the status of someone seeking a high place in a kingdom. To welcome a child doesn't increase one's status. It doesn't elevate one. To give hospitality to wealthy or reputable people, that will increase my status. And we know this in our world today. If we can somehow associate with someone who is of respectable position or admired by our peer set, if we can host them and make it known, if somehow we can grease our affiliation with them and make it known, what does that do to us within the status of our group? It raises us. Joel Green comments, taking a child, perhaps even the child he had just restored to health, Jesus places the child in a position of honor at his side, then makes a pronouncement that undermines everything that the Roman world would have taken for granted regarding questions of status and social relations. To welcome people would be to extend to them the honor of hospitality, to regard them as guests. But one would only welcome a social equal or one whose honor was above one's own. Children whose place of social residence was defined at the bottom of the ladder of esteem might be called upon to perform acts of hospitality, washing feet or the like, but normally they would not themselves be the recipients of honorable behavior. Jesus thus turns the social pyramid upside down, undermining the very conventions that led the disciples to deliberate over relative greatness within their company. Here's the cross. Here's what the cross looks like. It looks like people who have stopped seeking status amongst their peer set just so we can look better. The kingdom is about a different frame of mind. I am not seeking praise from people who could make me look better. I am going to go down. I am going to go to the helpless, and I am going to extend hospitality to them. And in Jesus' logic, it's the way down. It's becoming least. What does the text say that one becomes? Greatest. It's here where we need to contrast this text with what Jesus will say later in Luke 18 about welcoming the kingdom like a child. That's not here. Welcoming the kingdom like a child is welcoming the kingdom as one who, like a child here, has no rights, has no status, is just completely humbled. Jesus' statement about welcoming the kingdom like a child is between the Pharisee and the publican and the rich young ruler. In other words, don't be like that or like that. Welcome the kingdom like a child. Be one who's humble, one who has nothing and recognizes it, who has no rights, no power, who can only receive, can't contribute. That's the way is one is to enter the kingdom. Different here. This is not that. This isn't become like a child. It's become like one who's embracing the cross, going down, welcoming in people who will not raise your status. Don't be concerned about climbing the ladder. Be concerned about getting down. Jesus says the same thing, if you'll turn with me to Luke 14. Just a couple of pages over. It's the exact same idea. Luke 14, 12. He said to the one who invited him, Luke 14, 12, when you give a lunch or a dinner, here's hospitality. Don't invite your friends, your brothers, your relatives, your rich neighbors. That's the point. It's wealth and status and power. The framework then is the framework today. Human nature has not changed. If I can associate with people who are above me and I can host them and I can make that known, I instantly become more powerful than others in my group. I gain status. It's true in the ancient world, and is it not true today? A climbing for power, for status, to be known, to be an associate of that person gives me honor. It's about wealth and power, and it made Jesus sick. Don't invite your relatives, your rich neighbors. They'll invite you back and you'll be repaid. Verse 13, on the contrary, when you host a banquet, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, the lame, those who don't have anything. And then you'll be blessed because they cannot repay you. So who will? God. Do you see the logic of this now? Jesus is talking about the cross, and the status of the cross is downward to those who are thinking about the kingdom and ascending heights. Jesus says, do this. The least are the greatest. The way up is down. Welcome someone like this child. Welcome someone who has nothing. Give hospitality to them. Associate with those who have nothing and give them honor as if they were the associate you wish you could congregate with. That's greatness. Joel Green again. Jesus calls upon his followers to welcome those of the lowest status. That is, to act in this way is to perform in a way consistent with Jesus' own commitments and commission. To honor children is to honor Jesus, and to honor Jesus is to honor the one who sent him. God's way up is down. In a world climbing for power, just as the disciples were climbing for power, climbing to be known, let it be the case that we are people who are more concerned with giving ourselves away than gaining some status. It's about faithfulness. It's about trust in God. It's about trust in God to reward. About trusting in God to take care of not just the clout, the power, the prestige, the status that we could have today. Because isn't that what's underneath the pursuit of status? It's power, it's control. Can't God take care of us? I mean, underneath this is, are we going to trust in the faithfulness of God or social mechanisms and ladder climbing for success? Who's more faithful? God, who raised his son from the dead, or the system in trying to work it so that we can one-up those around us? I don't know about you, but I'm so tired of trying to one-up or fight the way. That's just a waste of time. Let's just give ourselves away and trust God. And that kind of faithfulness, that kind of trust in God is consistent with verses 49 and 50. John responded to this And notice his response is yet protectionism. It's yet status. It's yet seeking to maintain his position, to be an insider and one who can be critical of those outside. Master, we saw someone driving out demons in your name. We tried to stop him because he does not follow us. What did Jesus say? My message is bigger than you. Isn't that essentially what it is? Don't stop him. He who isn't against you is for you. It's not protectionism. It's not maintaining power. It's not seeking status. Look at me. You better check with us first before you preach about Jesus, John is saying. Something much bigger in play. It's about faithfulness and belief. It's how the cross demonstrates the power of God's kingdom. It's such an upside-down way of life. That's why we need each other to be a people who together think differently, that we think that down is really up, and we are here to build one another up. Because if we live this way in this faithful framework, what will the world think of us? Less and less. Go ahead, go down, they say. Well, we are the people to build one another in that state.